Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, a radio show where we talk about a subject that affects you every day, the United States Constitution. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from WETS-FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. Guess what? You can visit us on Facebook, and there you can listen to one of our podcasts. I hope you will. Today's subject is another strange constitutional term, one you've no doubt heard this time, judicial activism. Judicial activism. What does it mean to be a judicial activist? Well, as you might guess, this has garnered a great deal of attention, not just in the courts, not just in the political realm, but also from constitutional scholars. And one of those scholars, a fellow by the name of Kermit Roosevelt from the University of Pennsylvania Law School, is going to be here with us in just a few minutes to talk about his book called The Myth of Judicial Activism. But first, to set things up for us, is my student, Eugene Belenitsky from the Appalachian School of Law. Welcome, Eugene.
Hello. Nice to be back.
All the way from the Ukraine via New Jersey and Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania, then New Jersey.
Pennsylvania, then New Jersey, Southwest Virginia, and Johnson City, Tennessee. Eugene Belenitsky. And what are you going to tell us about judicial activism?
Judicial activism, it's one of those terms, there's really no definition without context.
Okay.
So to start off, the traditional definition is that it's a philosophy of judicial decision-making whereby judges allow their personal views about public policy, amongst other factors, to guide their decision.
Okay, so a judicial activist, by that basic definition, is anybody who lets his personal feelings or biases affect how he or she judges a case.
Right.
Okay, well, gosh, that's, to some extent, it probably describes every judge who's ever judged. And
It's a very broad one.
Yeah, it's a very broad standard, but of course, in the extreme, it really is an insult to a judge, isn't it? Because it suggests that the judge is not doing his or her job.
Yeah, and in fact, legal experts have said that in practice, activists, it's just someone that the whoever's saying that doesn't agree with their decision.
I see. So sometimes it's just name-calling when we call somebody a judicial activist.
That's right.
I see. Where did this term come from?
Well, the history of this term is also very interesting. It was first used by a fellow named Arthur Schlesinger.
The eminent historian.
That's right. And he introduced this term in 1947 in his article in Fortune magazine titled The Supreme Court 1947.
Very interesting. Let's give it a little bit more context. In 1947, of course, right after the death of FDR, right after the conclusion of World War II, we had what's sometimes called the New Deal Court or the Roosevelt Court. It was a court that had been, a majority of which, had been appointed by Franklin Roosevelt, one of the great liberal presidents of all time. And so Schlesinger was apparently not too happy with this court. What did he have to say about it?
Well, basically, without giving any sort of clear definition of what judicial activist is, he labeled all the judges as either a judicial activist or a champion of self-restraint.
Okay, so he set up a dichotomy, that's a fancy term, and he set up a contrast between those judges who engaged in proper self-restraint, on the one hand, and those
who didn't.
That's right. They were the activists. And, of course, they were the Roosevelt appointees, I'm imagining.
Right. On the activist side, you have Justice Black, Douglas, Murphy, and Rutledge.
Okay.
And on the self-restraint side, you have Frankfurter, mm-hmm. Jackson, Burton.
Well, actually, there was a mix there. Okay, so Schlesinger didn't divide them directly by who was appointed by Roosevelt and who wasn't, but apparently he had his favorites. And so what did he say about these judges?
Well, mostly he criticized the judicial activist judges, mostly Hugo Black and Douglas.
What had they done then? What was so terrible about Black and Douglas?
He kind of pointed out that they went to Yale and they had the whole Yale ideology of cynicism of the law. And he himself went to Harvard. So I'm wondering if there is some sort of a Yale-Harvard competitiveness going on there.
Wait a minute. This was some sort of spitting contest between Harvard and Yale?
I don't know. I don't know. It could be.
Boy, isn't it remarkable how even at the highest levels of our society, it comes down to, you know, I'm better than you are because my dad's bigger than you. Is that what Schlesinger was saying? Is that he simply didn't like the philosophy of the Yale Law School?
Well, he kind of described the view as a black Douglas activist view, particularly dominant at the Yale Law School.
Okay, so he's dissing Yale. All right, well, what exactly did Black say or Douglas say that made him so angry?
Well, that's also very interesting because all that he cites to back up why Black is an activist is Black's, quote, praising the federal courts as havens of refuge for those who might otherwise suffer because they are helpless, weak, outnumbered, or because they're nonconforming victims of prejudice and public excitement.
Wait, this was a bad thing?
Yeah.
It's a bad thing for the courts to be havens for the poor and the oppressed?
Well, on the one thing, it sounds great.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, why is the federal court this haven? I mean, we live in a democracy, right? Why should we have a court that takes the law that's supposed to be made by the majority and then use it to protect the minority and sort of oppress the majority?
Hmm, I see. Well, I guess there are two ways to look at it. Either you want to help the poor folk and the oppressed folk, or maybe you don't. Maybe you simply want judges who are going to apply the law, even if it's being used to hurt the poor folk or the oppressed folk. So, okay, well, I guess I see his point. There are a lot of people who might disagree with it, but I see his point, okay.
And what's interesting is that this quote kind of reminded me about the empathy comment that Obama was making when he was
Sotomayor. Okay, so yes, so when President Barack Obama nominated Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court, he said that he wanted justices with empathy. Okay, that does sound reminiscent of what Justice Black said, and I guess that's the same criticism then today.
And that also set off, as you remember, I don't even know how to describe what happened after he made that empathy comment.
There were a lot of people who said that was essentially judicial activism, that President Obama was looking for judicial activists, people who would judge with their hearts rather than judge by the law. And, okay, well, I guess I see where Schlesinger was going, and I see that even though perhaps he didn't define his term judicial activism very specifically, it does seem to have the same sense then, or did seem to have the same sense then, as it does as recently as the confirmation of Justice Sotomayor.
It does.
Okay.
And I'd argue that Schlesinger was not exactly accurate in his portrayal of Justice Black, because
There
were a few cases that one could argue that Justice Black was a textualist and
Textualist is someone, of course, who just looks at the text of the Constitution and tries to apply it as faithfully as he can. Consequences be damned. I mean, you're not worried about whether you're hurting the poor or the oppressed. You simply apply the law as you see it, as it reads in the Constitution. So when was Justice Black a textualist?
Well, when he interpreted the First Amendment, which says Congress shall make no law about religion.
Oh, right, yes.
And
he was a bit of an absolutist, wasn't he?
Right, and
whenever he applied,
that literally means Congress shall make no law
respecting an establishment of religion, or respecting free exercise, or infringing freedom of speech or the press. Yeah, in all of Supreme Court history, Justice Hugo Black is probably the closest thing we ever had to an absolutist when it comes to interpreting the First Amendment. Very much a textualist. It says no law, therefore no law is going to be constitutional. Whereas all the other justices, or most other justices throughout history, have been willing to read exceptions into that statement. So, Schlesinger's article doesn't seem to contemplate, then, all of Justice Black's case law.
Right.
What about Justice Douglas? Was there similar contradictions there?
I'm not sure about Justice Douglas.
You can probably make a lot better argument that he probably fit most people's definition of an activist, because He didn't pay a lot of attention necessarily to the text if it interfered with what his conception of what the outcome in the case should be. I mean, obviously there's complexity there, but Justice Douglas probably did fit many people's definition of what an activist is, because he had a very very interpretive school of thought that informed his interpretation of the Constitution.
Well, yeah, but even then, if you look at the Korematsu decision, where Justice Douglas, I think, voted to allow the president to go on with the internment of the Japanese prisoners. Even that shows that that description of him as a judicial activist is incorrect.
And okay. Well, maybe what we should say here is that every judge, or no judge, no justice, is ever completely consistent in what he or she does right. when it comes to any sort of arbitrary term such as judicial activism. So there are going to be justices and judges who sometimes get criticized as being activists and sometimes are going to be very textualist in their holdings, including Justice Douglas. And so it really sort of underscores the inherent limitations of any such labeling that go on.
Exactly. It's a case-by-case analysis, and maybe one opinion will be an activist one and another one won't be.
Okay. Well, we certainly have muddied the waters on this one, haven't we? What else can you tell us about judicial activism since 1947 when this term first appeared?
Well, the big question, of course, is it good or bad? Mm-hmm. And I have a few cases here that will allow listeners or you to decide.
Okay, what
yourself.
Are some of these
is it
cases?
Good or bad?
Okay, what do you think?
Well, one example is Brown versus the Board of Education.
Right.
And that's, of course, the case that purportedly ordered desegregation to begin in the South, across the United States.
It did. It did eventually order that, the Brown versus Board of Education. And yeah, it's often criticized as being judicial activism because of the people who dislike the decision, and there are many of them, say that the Constitution says nothing about segregation in schools and that the Equal Protection Clause, which was adopted in 1867 as part of the 14th Amendment, was written and adopted by a bunch of white men, most of whom never would have sent their kids to school with black children. So how could we say that the Equal Protection Clause protects black children from school segregation? I mean, that is a criticism that is sometimes leveled against Brown, and yet most people in our day and age think of Brown as being a good decision.
Yeah, I'd have a hard time arguing that Brown was a poor decision.
Right, yeah, but there are those who do. Certainly it can be criticized. Okay, what other decisions have been criticized as being judicial activism?
Obviously the Roe v. Wade decision, probably the most known decision as a activist decision.
Yeah, in fact, I think one definition of judicial activism wasn't it Al Gore who said if you accuse somebody of judicial activism, essentially you're saying that's somebody who would support Roe versus Wade.
Yeah,
right?
that seems to be the litmus test in politics these days.
It certainly does. And again, the idea is that Roe versus Wade, which constitutionalized abortion, which said that women had rights to abortion in some circumstances. The criticism is that their Constitution certainly doesn't mention the word abortion, and it doesn't mention the underlying concept of privacy upon which the Roe decision was based. And so maybe that's an activist decision.
Right. And it could be.
Yeah, it certainly can be characterized that way, whether you agree with it or not.
And both sides of the aisle have the opinions that they label
sure.
activist and defend the other ones. Another one on here is Bush v. Gore.
The ones the liberals hate. The people.
Exactly.
So we've been talking about decisions that maybe more conservative people dislike. Certainly Roe versus Wade, the social conservatives don't like. But the liberals hate Bush versus Gore.
Yep.
That was a very controversial decision, of course, which essentially handed the White House to George W. Bush, and which, according to many people, flew in the face of very extensive, precedent from a variety of sources, stretching back a number of years. And the court itself specified that the decision was sort of a one-day affair and was not to be cited in future future arguments, and that certainly subjected it to further criticism. Roe versus Wade, Brown versus Board of Education, and Bush versus Gore are all arguably, according to some people, judicial activism. So you've just muddied the water even more.
I know. I'm sorry.
Well, is this something that's discussed even today? I mean, is this still
well,
current?
Well, yeah, in our day, the cases that we're looking at that might get the label, the judicial activist label, are the gay marriage opinions that are coming out and the healthcare opinions that are coming out.
Yep. Courts that have found a state constitutional right to gay marriage are often criticized as being activists because, of course, I don't think any constitution among the 50 states mentions gay rights explicitly. And then, of course, the healthcare law, which was passed a little while ago, is now being challenged. And the idea there is that it simply nowhere does the Constitution say anything about healthcare and about making people buy in health insurance. And so interpreting the Constitution to allow that would be an activist interpretation.
Yeah, and in fact, in one recent opinion, U.S. District Judge Roger Vinson has said that Congress exceeded the bounds of its authority in regards to that law.
So he obviously would not, did not find that the law was constitutional.
Yeah, and he was criticized right away by White House spokeswoman Stephanie Cutter and Department of Justice.
And what did she say?
Well, the Stephanie Cutter said that today's ruling is a plain case of judicial overreaching.
Oh, good grief. So basically, it really seems to be true that whatever you disagree with, whether you're a liberal or conservative or whatever political stripe you are, whenever a court does or fails to do something that either you want or don't want, then that court is a judicial activist court.
Right. I mean, usually you would think that judicial activist court is a court that would strike down a conservative law like DOMA, Defense of the Marriage Act,
right?
And then the liberals would cry out. I mean, the conservatives would cry out. Now I'm confused.
That's all right. It gets very confusing because you know, it's conservatives look at it one way, liberals look at it another way, and I think that's really all that we can say. That looking at the history of this, it was a muddled idea from the very beginning. It was infused with politics from the very beginning. It's never something that one can apply in any sense accurately to any particular judge or justice over the course of his or her career. And essentially, it boils down to a lot of name-calling, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
All right, after a quick break, we'll be back with our constitutional quiz and then an interview with Kermit Roosevelt. Stay tuned.
What did she say? What you say? That you only meant well.
Jason Derulo.
That it's all for the best. Cause it is.
I was so wrong for so long. Only trying to please myself. Girl, I was caught up in her lust. When I don't really want no one else.
It's constitutional quiz time, so let's talk to Kelly Carmichael from all the way over at the Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Kelly, how you doing?
I am good, and I have a good question for you.
Tremendous. What's our quiz question this week?
Well, today I want to, you know, talk about citizenship.
Citizenship.
In our country, and the question is, in American constitutional democracy, citizens are expected to do what? And the choices are... A, promote their individual rights without regard to the common good. B, allow government to assume responsibility for solving social problems. C, ignore their own personal interests when making political decisions. Or D, think critically about public issues and participate in public affairs.
Oh, my God. Those are all very interesting answer choices. But the question, again, is that Americans are expected to do something by the Constitution?
What are citizens in an American constitutional democracy expected to do?
See, that's very interesting because on the one hand, you know, the straight textual answer is nothing at all.
Nothing.
Yeah, I mean, the Constitution doesn't impose any sort of requirement that we act in any particular way, but this might come under the heading of basic foundational theory. I mean, if you're going to have a representative democracy, which is, of course, what we have in our Constitution, what does that mean? What are the responsibilities of citizenship? Recall that oftentimes our history is called the American experiment. And it really is an experiment. And the question of the experiment is, can people govern themselves? Can people govern themselves? Or do we automatically devolve into some sort of authoritarian regime where we... let other people, powerful people, make decisions for us simply because they are powerful, simply because they have force that they can use.
And so that's what we're talking about. We're talking about one of the foundational theories that undergirds our whole idea of self-government. Okay, well, with that fancy preamble, why don't we go and actually look at the flight of fancy there. Let's talk about the actual answer choices and see which one of those might qualify.
Sure. The first answer choice was that our citizens expected to promote their individual rights without regard to the common good.
Well, you know, there are those who espouse that perspective, aren't there?
That is true.
You know, there are the sort of the, you know, I've got mine and the heck with the rest of you sort of people. And I'm not going to mention any names. You can decide who takes that perspective. But, you know, though that's certainly one perspective that one often hears. If everybody's completely selfish in everything that he or she does, then you're not going to have a lot of what the founders like to call civic virtue, are you?
That is true.
Yeah, so I doubt that one's going to qualify. What about answer choice B?
Especially considering that, you know, the idea of common good is certainly a foundational principle of our society. So saying that it's the answer says without regard to the common good really goes against the idea.
Yeah,
of American
that really goes
democracy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even if you're a believer in a free market system, which also is not mentioned in the Constitution, but is certainly, you know, something that is commonly perceived as an important part of our American society. Even if you believe in the free market and acknowledge that people behave selfishly and that can have good results, it's not exactly what you'd say as a theoretical basis for a community, for a government where people have to get together and think about the common good. So, yeah, I think answer choice A we can cross off.
And that then takes us to answer choice B, which is, are citizens expected to allow government to assume responsibility for solving social problems? that could open a can of worms here.
There are certainly those who think that as well. You know, just let the government do it.
And there are certainly those who scream and say, no way.
Exactly. So, and again, I won't name names or party labels or any of those things, but certainly that is something that one hears. But that's sort of the opposite end of the spectrum. If you simply say, well, let's just let the government do it, that kind of lets the individual entirely off the hook, doesn't it?
That is true.
So that's a bit of an extreme as well. So I think maybe we've seen in choices A and B two opposite sides of the spectrum, and so maybe we can cross both of those off. What about C?
And then C is, are citizens expected to ignore their own personal interests when making political decisions?
Well, that's what we call the Gandhi theory. Perhaps the Jesus Christ theory of government, which is, you know, don't worry about yourself and sacrifice yourself for others. Well, that's maybe going a bit too far as well, isn't it?
That is correct.
Nobody expects, certainly none of our constitutional theorists expect that all of our citizens to be Christ-like in everything they do. They were realists. I mean, certainly there were theoreticians among our founders, but they were pragmatists for the most part as well.
Certainly, Madison recognized that was the case.
Yeah.
In creating the Constitution and articulated the need to ratify the Constitution. Saying that people are different. People do vote and based on their interests, and it's okay. We will survive as a nation.
Yep. Absolutely. So I think we can cross.
He said it in a much better way than I just said it.
You know, James Madison had a way with words, didn't he?
He did. He did.
And he I think the founders often put us to shame, don't they? They do indeed.
They do.
What about answer choice D? I sure hope that's a good one.
It is a good one. Again, the question was, in American constitutional democracy, citizens are expected to, and the answer choice D is, think critically about public issues and participate in public affairs.
And that, of course, is the correct answer. And the way that they become citizens like that is by taking the We the People curriculum and learning it, right?
Yeah, the We the People curriculum that I run here in Virginia, but I know your viewing area or listening area is also in surrounding states. So fortunately, We the People is available all states. Across the country.
Right. But that's how you become a critical thinking, enlightened citizen. And that's why answer choice D is correct. So,
I have a great quote by James Madison.
Oh, yes.
He once said that the people ought to be enlightened, to be awakened, to be united, that after establishing a government, they should watch over it as well as obey it.
That is a fantastic quote, and of course, that's the whole reason we have this radio show. So all of our listeners can take comfort in the fact that they are living up to James Madison's ideal of citizenship merely by tuning into WETS and listening to your weekly constitutional. Thank you, Kelly. Thank you for that validation. All right, till next time.
Okay. See you next week.
Okay, bye-bye.
Now it's time for us to talk to Kermit Roosevelt, a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania and the author of a book, The Myth of Judicial Activism, Making Sense of Supreme Court Decisions, published in 2006. Well, Kermit Roosevelt, thank you so much, very much, for being with us today on your weekly constitutional. Could you tell us what this strange term, judicial activism, means?
Well, judicial activism is a funny thing, because in one sense, everyone agrees on what it is, and in another sense, no one does. So everyone agrees, basically, judicial activism is a bad thing. And if we had to try to define it in an operational way, it would be something like judges deciding cases based on their policy preferences or their political views rather than the law or the Constitution. So that's bad, right? Judges are supposed to decide based on the law, based on the Constitution. They shouldn't be taking their own political views into account. If they do that, they're activists. It's bad.
Okay,
and that's
so
what everyone sort of agrees on.
That's
but
what
then people don't agree about which decisions are activists.
Oh, of course not. Of course not. Well, before we leave that first concept that judicial activism is bad, that's what the Chief Justice was talking about during his confirmation hearings, wasn't it, when he compared judges to umpires?
Yes.
Yeah, the umpires, if I recall correctly, I'm paraphrasing, umpires were there to call balls and strikes, but nobody came to a ball game to see an umpire.
Yes. Well, so this is, you know, this is an image that has a lot of power with the American people. No one likes to think that we're being ruled by judges who are making the law rather than just applying it. And it's actually become a pretty common feature of Supreme Court confirmation hearings. Now, everyone swears not to be an activist. Everyone swears, you know, I will faithfully apply the law, I will be modest, I will understand that my role is not to make the law, but just to apply it in this neutral, almost mechanical way.
Okay.
Now, whether it's actually possible to do that in a controversial case, that's another question.
Okay. But, okay, everybody agrees, then, that judicial activism is bad, and that's the way we typically hear it responded to, is that judges will say, oh, no, I'm not an activist, I'm just an umpire. Okay, so, and what's the other part, then, of your discussion of what judicial activism is?
Well, the other part is that this idea of judicial activism as judges behaving badly, deciding cases based on their own political preferences rather than the law, it's actually not very useful because no one can agree on when they're doing it. So,
well, I know when they're doing it. They're doing it when they make a decision I disagree with, right?
Well, exactly. Exactly. So, you know, and individuals have very strong opinions about particular cases, but they tend to be cases that those individuals don't like on political grounds.
Right.
So, you know, the left now has its sort of bête noire of activism, which is the Citizens United case.
Yep.
And people on the right say, oh, no, that's just the straight-up enforcement of the First Amendment. They're not making the law. They're just applying it.
And that was the case where the court increased the amount of money that could go into political campaigns.
Right. So the court has an expansive view of the First Amendment rights of corporations.
Right. And so the more left-leaning people don't like that decision, and so they call that an activist decision.
Right. The left-leaning people say that's activist. If you ask the people on the right, they'll say something like Roe v. Wade, recognizing abortion rights, that's activist.
So is judicial activism just name-calling, then?
Well, it pretty much is. You know, I think that if you look at the public dialogue, the way that judicial activism is used, it's really not helpful. It sounds as though it's appealing to something beyond merely, I don't like this decision. But when you boil it down, that's really all it is.
For heaven's sake.
If I don't like this decision, I'm going to register my disapproval in the strongest possible terms.
Well, I'm going to guess, then, that is why you titled your book The Myth of Judicial Activism.
Yes.
Okay. Well, tell us about that mythology, then,
and why it's
a problem.
I chose that title for two reasons. Basically, one is that there's just no consensus on which decisions are activist and which aren't. So in that sense, it's a myth. The other is that I'm pretty sure, I'm almost 100% sure, that if you could sort of get inside the heads of the judges making these decisions, no judge is thinking to himself or herself, here's a chance for me to ignore the law or ignore the Constitution and decide based on my personal preferences. You know, they all are, I'm almost 100% sure, sincerely trying to do the right thing, to apply the law as they understand it. They just have different views of what the law means, and they have different views about the appropriate relationship between the court and, say, Congress or state legislatures.
Okay, well, I'm just grasping here then. Is a solution to this problem, or is there a bedrock principle here? I believe it's sometimes called originalism, or sometimes strict originalism. Would that solve this problem, this dilemma, and make sure that judges are not being activists? Can we just resort to that?
Well, that's been one of the projects of constitutional theory for a long time, actually, trying to find some way of interpreting the Constitution that will take all of the indeterminacy out of it, so that judges won't have any choice. You won't have the danger of judicial discretion where policy concerns might enter into the decision.
Well, that solves the problem then, doesn't it? I mean, if we simply say we'll just read what the Constitution says and we'll just do what it says, and if it's not entirely clear, we'll just figure out what the people who wrote it meant and we'll do what they would have done. Doesn't that solve any problem of judicial activism?
Well, you know, with some constitution it could, but with our constitution it doesn't. And there's basically two reasons for that. One is the constitution is going to have to be applied to situations that the founders not only didn't imagine, but really couldn't have imagined. So, you know, one interesting question that's arisen recently in the First Amendment context is, should you treat cable TV differently from broadcast TV?
You mean they didn't have cable in 1787?
No, didn't even have broadcast. And, you know, the idea of distinguishing between the two, what would James Madison have said? We've got no idea. Originalism just can't answer that question. Then the second problem is, you've got some constitutional provisions that are just vague. They're written in general terms. If you look at the debates surrounding their drafting and their ratification, it seems pretty clear what the drafters and the ratifiers were trying to do was put a general principle in there. So the Equal Protection Clause, it says no state shall deny any person equal protection of the laws. Pretty much everyone agrees that's supposed to prevent some kinds of unfair discrimination. And people thought certain kinds of discrimination were unfair at the time this was drafted, but they didn't say, you know, look to what we thought. They put in this general principle. They probably understood that future generations would struggle over the question, you know, is discrimination against women unfair? Now we tend to think it is. At the time, they didn't. Is segregation of public schools unfair? Now we think it is. At the time, they didn't. Is discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation unfair? Well, that's a struggle that's still going on. But
right.
It's pretty clear that the intent of the drafters and ratifiers was to put in a general provision whose application to specific contexts in the future would be sort of fought out in the arena of public opinion.
Yeah, I think there's one other major problem there. You may have alluded to it, and that is, you know, how do we figure out exactly what they thought 200 years ago?
Right. We've got some records. We've got better records for some things than others. But generally speaking, to the extent that you can find agreement among the drafters and the ratifiers, it's at a very high level of generality.
Yeah.
So I was just talking about the Equal Protection Clause. People agree, you know, everyone who voted in favor would agree, this prohibits unfair discrimination. But some people actually did think, probably at the time, that racially segregating public schools was unfair. Lots of people didn't. Pretty much no one thought that a ban on interracial marriages was unfair.
So maybe even talking about original meaning assumes a unanimity of opinion that never existed.
Yeah, it doesn't exist with the degree of precision that you would need to answer the questions that actually come up.
Okay, so original meaning and the so-called strict constructionism, or you know, I realize I'm mixing a lot of terms here, but this idea to try to find some sort of bedrock principle to interpret the Constitution is not going to solve this problem of judicial activism. If that's not going to solve it, then what will?
Well, I don't think that anything can solve it. I don't think that anything can solve it in the sense of taking all of the discretion away from judges. And that's why we care who our judges are. You know, that's why we have confirmation hearings. That's why people pay a lot of attention to judges' backgrounds and their prior writings. Because judging requires judgment. You know, you can't make it into a mechanical process. So is that a bad thing? Well, I don't think so. We could have written a constitution that was completely mechanical in its application, maybe, where every provision is something like the president has to be at least 35 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone will agree on how that applies. You don't have any discretion. But it's probably a better system to have a constitution that has some open-ended provisions, and it's probably better to have the American people work out the meaning of those constitutional commitments over time. So I don't think it's a problem, I guess, is my answer.
So judges matter, and judges are necessary. And so we want to pick judges whose values we share.
Yeah, we want to pick judges whose values we share. And then what I say in the book is the basic thing that we should be concerned about probably is when judges think that issues can more or less be left up to the political process, and when they think that judicial supervision or interference is necessary.
So that's how you look at the role of a judge, as the degree of deference that judge is willing to give to others, to other governmental actors?
Yes, and I think that's pretty much the basic theme running through our constitutional law, is that sometimes courts are very deferential, they're very hands-off. They say to the legislatures, to Congress or state legislatures, basically, you can do whatever you want unless you're completely crazy. But sometimes they adopt a much less deferential position. Sometimes they say, you know, you're going to have to convince us that what you're doing here is absolutely necessary for some very important state interest, and otherwise we're going to strike it down. And the key question, I think, and this is really a question that you don't need a law degree to evaluate, is the court being deferential in, you know, a sensible set of cases, and is it being non-deferential in a sensible set of cases? You know, does it have reasons for the level of deference that it's adopted?
Okay, I want to go back over this again because this might be a little bit difficult for non-lawyers for lawyers too. I mean, this is a difficult concept. You have a court. It has a universe of cases. Let's say it has 100 cases that come to it in a given year. And those cases, many of those cases, involve other branches of the government. The Congress has passed a statute that someone says is unconstitutional, or a state legislature has done the same thing, or the president has done something and someone is saying that's unconstitutional. So among these 100 cases that involve constitutional law, it has actions of other governmental actors that it has to evaluate. And it has to say, well, we think the president did well or did not do well here, or acted constitutionally or didn't act constitutionally. And what you're saying, if I understand you correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that we as citizens evaluating whether the court is being activist or not simply need to look at the degree that the court is willing to defer to the president or willing to defer to Congress or to a state legislature, and whether it's given the proper deferential level or not.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe I can give a couple more specific examples.
Okay, great.
So I mentioned the Equal Protection Clause before. It says no state shall deny any person the equal protection of the laws.
Right.
It means something like people agree, you know, states can't discriminate in certain ways. And if you look at what the court has done with that, it's adopted an approach where it says basically, with lots of kinds of discrimination, we're going to leave it up to you. So if the state decides it's going to treat people differently based on their age, so it's got a mandatory retirement age, say, the Supreme Court is going to say, that's okay, unless it's irrational, basically, unless the law that you've chosen is not rationally connected to any legitimate state interest, unless it seems like the legislature has gone insane. Basically, they can do what they want, treating people differently on the basis of age.
Okay.
If they're using race, on the other hand, if they want to treat people differently based on race, the Supreme Court says, you've got to show us that this is necessary to serve some very important government interest.
Okay, so there are just certain types of cases, certain types of discrimination where the red flags go up, and the court says, hold on, wait a second, we're not just going to give you a free pass on this, or we're not going to let you do pretty much what you want to do on this. We're going to look at this much more closely.
This is Stuart Harris, and you've been listening to my conversation with Kermit Roosevelt, a professor of law at the University of Pennsylvania, who's been wrestling with a very difficult concept of judicial activism. We'll hear more from Professor Roosevelt in a little while. We're going to take a little break, and after the break, we're going to have a constitutional story. Stay tuned. Time again for a constitutional story, but this time I'm going to ask you to put yourself in the story. I'm going to ask you to imagine that your name is Fred. Doesn't matter if you're a woman. It could be Winifred, or it could be Frederick, but at any rate, your name is Fred, and you are a native-born, law-abiding American citizen. You go to high school. You play sports. You work part-time jobs, you don't get into any trouble, you're an all-American kid. But you're a little different from the people around whom you live, and so from time to time, they make fun of you, or they treat you differently just because of your last name, just because of the way you look. Well, you get used to this, you know that you're different. You see the way people treat your family, and you deal with it. But then something happens. The country that your family originally came from years ago, and remember, almost everybody in the United States came from someplace else, but you have the bad luck of coming from a country that launches an attack on the United States. And all of a sudden, everybody in the United States is angry at the country of your ancestors. Well, that's pretty bad, and it's pretty uncomfortable. But imagine this. Within just a few weeks, the President of the United States authorizes the military to take you away, to force you to leave your home, to force your family to leave its home, and the army comes and wants to load you in a bus and take you to what sounds an awful lot like a concentration camp. What would you do? Well, if your name really was Fred, and if your last name was Korematsu, you'd refuse to go. That's what Fred Korematsu did in the early 1940s, after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, after the U.S. Army declared a military exclusion zone on the West Coast for pretty much anyone of Japanese ancestry, including native-born American citizens. Fred Korematsu resisted. He went so far as to have surgery on his eyelids to make them look less Japanese. He was going to go underground and escape this terrible circumstance. Now, that wasn't because he wasn't patriotic. Oh, no. In fact, Fred had already tried to join the American military sometime before. He'd been rejected. He'd tried to work in a defense industry. He'd actually taken a job as a welder in a shipyard in California and had been fired when the fellow in charge had said he was not going to have any of those, I use the term advisedly, any of those Japs working in his shipyard. So Fred was a good American who wanted to help his country, but he was being prevented from doing so. He was arrested, he was convicted, and he was put in jail. And then, after all of that, he got shipped out to the internment camp anyway. When he arrived at the particular internment camp he was sent to,
He, like many of his other family members and friends and other Japanese Americans, was housed in a makeshift shelter that had previously been a horse stall. His comment upon arriving was, "Jail was better than this." Fred stayed in this camp for the duration of the war, but he didn't stop fighting. His case was appealed all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And in 1944, the court agreed to consider whether the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution put any limit on this kind of internment, of this kind of imprisonment of people who had committed no crime simply because they were of a particular nationality or ancestry. The court considered carefully what it should do in such a circumstance. The court announced a very strict test that lawyers called strict scrutiny. And it said that if the government is going to discriminate on the basis of race, and that's all that was going on here, because there were no German Americans that were put into mass internment camps, and there were no Italian Americans put into internment camps. If it was going to discriminate on the basis of race, it had to have a really, really compelling reason, and the discrimination had to be the only way that it could satisfy that compelling reason. So the court announced this very, very strict test, and you'd be justified in thinking, oh, well, Fred's going to win his case. No. The court held that the United States did have a compelling reason here to discriminate, and that was to protect itself after the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. And moreover, that the only way that it could be sure of protecting itself from Japanese espionage or sabotage was to forcibly remove all Japanese Americans from the West Coast. So what a strange circumstance, a strict test, and an outcome that even to this day many people describe as among the worst decisions in the history of the United States Supreme Court. Fred lost his case, the war was over, he and his family were released, and he lived his life, for the most part, very quietly. But as time passed and as people came to realize just how wrong it had been to intern all of those law-abiding American citizens, none of whom ever engaged in any acts of disloyalty, well, things started to change. And eventually, Fred Korematsu was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Bill Clinton. When Fred Korematsu died in 2005, his family erected a headstone with an enlarged version of that medal. And Fred Korematsu truly is an American constitutional hero.
It's time to finish our conversation with Professor Kermit Roosevelt of the University of Pennsylvania Law School. We're discussing judicial activism, and we're talking about Professor Roosevelt's theory that there are times when it's appropriate for a court to defer to another branch of government, and there are times when it's not.
Right. And so then your question would be, you know, does the court have a good reason for saying legislatures, you get a pass with age, but not with race? Or, you know, even within the category of racial discriminations, do you want to say, you know, legislature, we trust you if you're using affirmative action to increase diversity, or, you know, we don't trust you when you're excluding blacks from the public schools in the South?
Okay, well, what sort of rationalizations, what sort of justifications do the courts give for giving less deference to a legislature on an issue of race than it would, for example, on an issue of age?
Well, there's a couple, and the court shifts back and forth between them, and they don't all necessarily explain exactly what's happening. But the main ones are probably, first, racial groups are a minority. So if you're talking about discrimination against a racial minority, that looks like a situation where maybe the legislature doesn't necessarily take the interests of that minority into account adequately. So you're going to get unfair discrimination against them just because the political process doesn't adequately represent their interests.
That's right. Okay, in a majoritarian system where the majority rules, if you're a member of a minority, well, then maybe politics won't work for you.
Right. Politics maybe won't work for you, particularly if there's some sort of prejudice or hostility.
Right, and in fact, that's another part of it, is that there's a long history of racial discrimination in this country and
so
elsewhere.
History is the other factor. History is maybe the most important factor
okay. That
the court uses. If there's a history of treating a group unfairly, or sort of more generally, if there's a history of the legislature doing bad things, then the court tends to get very suspicious in that context. And here, of course, we do have a history of bad racial discrimination. So for that reason, the court has basically said, states, you can't use racial classifications at all.
Okay. Well, of course, we have fancy terms for these in law. We call the highest level of deference, we call the lowest level of scrutiny, we call that rational basis scrutiny, right?
Right.
And that basically says that, as you said, to paraphrase, that if as long as the legislature's not going crazy, we're going to let the legislature discriminate the way it wants to. But in these red flag areas, such as race or to some extent such as gender, if the legislature or some other governmental actor comes out and discriminates, we say we're going to give them heightened scrutiny. And we're going to look much more closely at what they do, and that means we're giving them less deference.
Right.
Okay, so if just to sum up then, if the courts are getting that right, if they're deciding that certain cases should be scrutinized more than other cases are, then that's pretty much the best we can do to assure ourselves that they're not engaging in some sort of inappropriate activism.
Yeah, I think if they're getting the level of deference right, then they're doing a pretty good job. You know, if they can give a sensible explanation for why they're using the level of deference they are, and in particular, if that explanation explains not just what they're doing in one area of constitutional law, but if they're consistently following that explanation in other areas, then I think you can be pretty sure that they're operating in good faith. You know, they're being driven by real constitutional concerns and not political considerations.
Very interesting. And what I find most interesting about this perspective of yours, and this is, you know, the basic thrust of the book, which incidentally I enjoyed very much when I read it a couple of years ago.
Thank you.
It's a good book. What I find most interesting is that it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to agree with a particular outcome in a particular case.
Right. Well, you know, we can't measure the court by whether we agree with the outcomes in particular cases, I think, at least not if we're talking about activism. Because activism is a very serious charge. It's not just saying, I think the court got this wrong. It's saying the court really abandoned the judicial role. The court is acting like a legislature, not like judges. So to call something activist just because you don't like the outcome really sort of debases our public discourse.
Okay, so
it leads people to think that policy disagreements are grounds for condemning the court rather than just disagreeing.
So, if I may paraphrase, then we as citizens, as we look at the court, we shouldn't simply ask, do we agree with this decision or disagree with this decision? We should always ask ourselves, is this simply within the range of what the court should be doing or not? Is it giving the appropriate level of deference to some government actor or not? And if we answer that yes, that it's acting correctly, then we should be willing to accept decisions that we wouldn't necessarily make if we were wearing the black robes.
Yes, and especially decisions that we wouldn't necessarily vote for if we were thinking about our policy preferences.
Now that's a rather high-minded thesis. Isn't that rather a hard thing to do?
Well, yes, it is. But, you know, I think it's better than the partisan name-calling.
I understand. I noticed in particular that one decision that you identified as being within the proper realm of judicial discretion, therefore not an activist case, was one of the more infamous cases in the constitutional canon. That was the Korematsu case.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the case where the Supreme Court approved the detention of Japanese Americans during World War II without individual hearings as to their loyalty. And even though I'm going to assume here that, I'm not going to assume anything. How do you feel about that case, and why do you think it's within the range that we would call it a legitimate exercise of the court's power?
Well, I think it was a bad decision. I hope that if I had been on the court at the time, I would have gone the other way. Certainly now I would.
Right.
It's a little bit hard to judge things by hindsight. But what made Korematsu a difficult decision was, on the one hand, you had, yes, this obvious gross infringement on people's liberty, moreover being done on race-based grounds, which should make you more suspicious of it, probably. But on the other hand, you've got the president, you've got Congress, the Department of Justice, the Army, all of them saying, this is necessary. This is a necessary wartime measure for national security. And if you read more deeply into the documents from that case, that's basically what the justices were saying. They were saying, look, we're 9 men in Washington. Are we really capable of second-guessing all of these experts as to what's necessary for national security? And in the end, they decided they weren't.
Very interesting. Well, Professor Kermit Roosevelt of the University of Pennsylvania Law School, thank you so much for talking to us today about judicial activism and your excellent book, The Myth of Judicial Activism. Any last thoughts?
I hope people read the book.
So do I. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, that was a great discussion with Professor Kermit Roosevelt of the University of Pennsylvania. But do we have any final thoughts from my student at the Appalachian School of Law, Eugene Belenitsky? You've been looking into this judicial activism thing. Is it still a matter of current interest?
It is, and in fact, it doesn't just happen in the United States.
No way.
Yeah.
This is an international concern.
Exactly.
Okay, well, what other judges or what other places are worried about judicial activism?
Israel.
Israel? What's happening in Israel?
Well, in Israel, Supreme Court Justice Aaron Barak has once said that a judge may give a statute new meaning. The statute remains as it was, but its meaning changes because the court has given it a new meaning that suits new social needs.
Well, well, well. We would call that a very interpretivist position. That's interpreting a statute to mean something else than it meant originally. Pretty flagrantly reinterpreting something. Is that judicial activism?
Who knows?
You're becoming a cynic, Eugene. All right. Well, who agrees with this justice from Israel, if anybody?
Interestingly, Elena Kagan, the newest Supreme Court justice, has said that he is her judicial hero.
Has that brought any criticism on Justice Kagan?
A little bit.
Uh-huh. From whom?
Well, mostly every single Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee.
I understand.
I have a quote from Senator Lindsey Graham. He said, "The one thing that bugs me about her is that when she embraces Judge Barak from Israel and the way he thinks about the way he writes as her hero, that to me is embracing liberal activism, not mainstream liberalism, and she's going to have to explain that to me and other members of the committee."
Oh, my goodness gracious. Any other Republicans have any choice words for Justice Kagan?
Well, not just for Justice Kagan, but overall, Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama, one of the top Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee, has said, "Down one path is the traditional American legal system, where judges impartially apply the law to the facts without regard to their own personal views. And down the other path lies a brave new world where judges are free to decide what facts they choose to see."
Thus spake Jeff Sessions, the paragon of impartiality. Well, we'll let him have the last word on that. But strangely, we find ourselves at the end of another pleasant hour discussing constitutional law. I want to thank my student, Eugene Belenitsky. I'd also like to thank Professor Kermit Roosevelt from the University of Pennsylvania. My name is Stuart Harris. Our producer is Wayne Winkler. We're speaking to you from WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee. And I think that's all I have to say. But remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.